News.
CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
And now here's your host, Carrie Baptist.
Good evening. In the news this week, we'll bring you highlights from the Impact Conference on Youth and Sustainability. We'll also be bringing you coverage of the Dalai Lama's recent visit, speaking at the Vancouver Peace Summit, and also coverage of recent Impact on Community Coalition panel discussion, looking at the impact of the Olympics on civil liberties in Vancouver. Finally, the Vancouver Police Department and Integrated Security Team announced this week that they would themselves go through the same training process as BCCLA legal observers. We'll have all this plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. For one weekend last month, 200 university students from across the country converged on the University of Guelph to take part in the Impact Sustainability Conference. The goal of the conference was to give students a unique learning experience and an opportunity to network with experts and like-minded youth from across the country. Reporter Bab Pepink was there and brings us this report on how youth are being integrated into the paradigm of sustainability.
The only two systems I know of that think they can grow forever are economics, and cancer cells. And both systems cannot grow indefinitely. But we've come to think that growth is the very definition of progress.
I'm sure you recognize the voice as that of Dr. David Suzuki. Comparing the economy to cancer cells, Dr. Suzuki was speaking at the Impact Youth Conference for Sustainability Leadership, hosted by the Cooperators in Guelph, Ontario, from September 24th to the 28th, which I was lucky enough to be a part of. The conference was a meeting of heads of 150 dedicated youth leaders from across Canada, from dozens of universities and colleges, all with different backgrounds, languages, cultures, and academic pursuits. We all vied for this opportunity to discuss the rather vague notion of youth and sustainability leadership at the weekend conference. And just as Dr. David Suzuki lambasted the abstract notions of progress and the megalithic economic entity, he epitomized the ethos of the conference. Rather than the ubiquitous why and the empty rhetoric associated with convincing individuals to adopt a sustainability paradigm, the conference was an opportunity to explore the how. This exploration actually centered around, what is the sustainability paradigm? I spoke with author Bob Willard about the difference between why and how. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I don't think there's a need to bring about the why message to these people, because obviously you're all change agents, you care about these things, so what you're trying to do is to make a difference. So very often what I try to do is encourage audiences to take that ownership, to get on with it. And that's not really an appropriate message for this group. So the value that I can perhaps add is how to do that in an effective way, how to marry some of the change agent techniques with that passion, so you're a more effective catalyst for change. It's one thing to have the passion, it's another thing to know how to connect with people and not just rant at them and beat them up and make them feel guilty, but also to engage them in this in a positive way so that they become another part of your army of sustainability champions trying to make the kind of changes that we need in the world soon enough that we can fix a lot of the problems that desperately need to be fixed. So I'm here more for the contribution of the how part than the why part.
And again, this notion of time was echoed by Dr. Suzuki, that we need more time in order to change what's going to happen in the future.
Well, people come to me all the time frustrated. What can I do as an individual? And that's why my foundation drew up a list of what we believe are the 10 most effective things that you as individuals can all do. And I hope after I leave here, there's going to be a spike at our website where suddenly all kinds of people are going to be signing up to take what we call the Nature Challenge, a commitment to doing some of these 10 things in the coming year. These are things that are, if every one of us did it in this room, it's a drop in the bucket. But if all Canadians did it, that's a bigger, we can fill a big bucket. We, of course, we need government, we need business on side doing some big things. We need time. And the more of us that get started on changing our lives by these simple, 10 little simple things, that buys us time because it lightens our ecological footprint.
Having established that we need time to own up to our future, the conference began to address how to become more sustainable. We already heard from Bob Willard, who advocates for the gentle shift of individual attitudes within the ongoing economic paradigm.
And there are basically two strategies for doing that.
That the sustainability
push can function within corporations to maintain our current system, and try to have that current system morph itself into something which is more
businesses.
Responsible,
Mr. Willard's views were shockingly contrasted by Nancy Mead.
And the other way is to work outside the system and create new parallel systems, which essentially ignore the old system and simply take it over by end-running it. That each of us fall in love with our particular approach and we think that's it, that's the magic pill that's going to do it. Absolutely not. We need a huge diversity of approaches, of techniques, of radicalness, of activism, to be able to all of us combine make these things happen. Some of us are trying, as I say, to work within, so we have a different style. But we need people just bamming at the corporate world from the outside, hammering them, getting their attention that way so that they kind of soften them up for guys like me to come along and say, no, you know, actually, we can make this work. So we need this combined effort so that we collectively meet at the same place. We're just using different doors to get there. I'm kind of using the Trojan horse approach to try to get inside the walls of this fortress called a corporation and help them see from the inside that maybe those walls should be torn down from the inside as opposed to from the outside. But I'll tell you, we can't wait for one of these things to be the answer. We need all of them in concert, and we need them fast.
Now that we're into this idea of how, I want to take one step back and look again at why. But instead of looking at why sustainability, I want to ask why youth? And why students? We could easily be approaching businesses, corporations, politicians, and leaders from across the country and the world and encouraging them to adopt sustainability practices so that we change the way things are going right now. So why were we approaching students and why academia? For an answer, I turned to Karen Farbridge, mayor of the city of Guelph, who served as a facilitator in group discussion at the conference. Here's what she had to say about universities.
Well, I think universities are going to play an enormous role in the whole dialogue and discussion around sustainability. I think we see from extremes, from all sectors and all sides of political spectrum, agendas at play, and a lot of misinformation and deliberate misinformation to inflame outrage in the public on one side of an issue and on the other side of the issue. We're going to need people who can cut through that chatter and focus us in on the facts. And there are some facts. Now, there's all kinds of room for dialogue around what you then do with the facts. But if we can't even get to those facts, then it's going to make finding the solutions even more challenging. So I think there's a real role for universities in that and students in that.
I also spoke with students at the conference and asked them why they were attending the conference and what they're hoping to accomplish. Here's what Troy had to say about student leadership.
I think the conference is organized in such a way that makes it strategically innovative, that when you look at even our age groups, we're all, youth 19 to 25. We're at that age where we're going to be moving from our university courses into different businesses and industries. And at the age that we're in, we're kind of in a middle ground where we have opportunities to impact right away, but also to shadow the people who are just below us entering maybe into universities or the younger youth in our communities.
And so it's this diversity that I believe the conference was hoping to advocate as the next step in sustainability. We can no longer believe that our individual ideas are enough to change the world, but we have to recognize that working together is the only way to step forward and secure a future for ourselves and the next generations. To conclude, I want to leave you with some closing words from Dr. David Suzuki.
The only two systems I know of that think they can grow forever are economics and cancer cells. And both systems cannot grow indefinitely. But we've come to think that growth is the very definition of progress. You ask a politician, you ask a business person, how well did you do last year? They'll immediately talk about how well their company grew or whether the GDP grew or did not grow. But growth is just a condition. It's just a statement about what happens to a system. Growth itself is nothing. It's just a state of a system. Surely growth is not an end. It's not what you're aiming for. It's just growth. You have to ask, what's the growth for? Can the growth go on forever? How much is enough? What's an economy for? Are we happier with all this stuff? I don't think we're asking the right questions because we got so fundamentally fixated in the idea that growth is the very definition. I'm going to show you why this is suicidal. Growth, steady growth, is called exponential growth. And energy is a predictable doubling time, okay? So whether it's the garbage, the size of your city, the number of people in the world, anything growing exponentially will double. If it's growing at 1% a year, it'll double in 70 years. 2% a year, it'll double in 35 years. 4%, 3% in 24 years. 4% in 17 and a half years. Anything growing exponentially will double in a predictable time. I'm going to give you a system analogous to the planet. It's a test tube full of food for bacteria. So the test tube and food are the planet, and we're going to put one bacterium in the cell, in the test tube, and that's us. And that bacterium is going to divide every minute. Okay? That's exponential growth. At the beginning, there's one cell. In 1 minute, there are two. 2 minutes, there are four. 3 minutes, there are eight. 4 minutes, 16. That's exponential growth. And at 60 minutes, the test tube is completely packed with food, bacteria, and there's no food left. Okay? So we've got a 60-minute growth cycle. When is the test tube only half full? And the answer, of course, is at 59 minutes. 59 minutes, it's only half full, but 1 minute later, it'll be completely full. So at 58 minutes, it's 25% full. At 57 minutes, it's 12.5% full. At 55 minutes of a 60-minute cycle, it's 3% full. If at 55 minutes, one of the bacteria said, hey guys, we got a population problem. The bacteria would say, Jack, what the hell have you been smoking, man? 97% of the test tube's empty and we've been around for 55 minutes. And they'd be 5 minutes away from filling it. So they're no smarter than people. 59 minutes ago, oh my God, Jack was right. We got 1 minute left. The hell are we going to do now? Don't give any money to those economists. Give it to those scientists. And by God, in less than a minute, those bacterial scientists invent three new test tubes full of food. So that would be like us suddenly discovering three more planet Earths that we could start using. So they're saved, right? They've quadrupled the amount of food in space. So at 60 minutes, test tube one's full. 61 minutes, test tube two is full. 62 minutes, all four are full. By quadrupling the amount of food in space, you buy two extra minutes. How can we add even a fraction of 1% more of air, water, soil, or biodiversity? You can't. It's fixed. It can't grow. And every scientist I've talked to agrees with me. We're past the 59th minute. So all this talk about we got to have more, we got to keep growing, is saying we've got to accelerate what is a suicidal path. Now, when I talk to politicians and business people, they get mad at me. How dare you say we're past the 59th minute? Look at our cities. They're filled with stuff. Look at our people. We're living longer. We're healthier. How dare you say we're past the 59th minute? I say it without apology, and I demand that anyone prove to me that I'm wrong. We are living with the illusion that everything's all right because we are using up the rightful legacy of our children and grandchildren. Any third-rate accountant will tell you, if you want to have an account that you want to keep forever, you don't dig in to the basic capital. You live on the interest. We are using up what is your rightful legacy.
And thanks, Brad, for bringing us that story. It's time for a break, but stay with us. Up next, Janelle Chung will be giving us her impressions of the speech made by the Dalai Lama at the recent Vancouver Peace Summit. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Look at his face. Is this an album cover? Oh, this is Alviro.
Talking about my generation.
Damn.
CITR 101.9 FM in conjunction with the Vancouver Film Festival present Discorama by Glacé. From 1959 to 1974, Denise Glacé's popular music program Discorama featured everyone who is anyone in French music, from Serge Gainsbourg and Charles Aznavour to Juliette Gréco and Johnny Hallyday. Esther Heffenberg's chronicle of the show is both a vividly entertaining film and an invaluable historical document. Discorama by Glacé, playing Thursday, October 1st at Van City Theatre, Sunday, October 4th at Pacific Cinémathèque, and Sunday, October 11th at Empire Granville. Brought to you by the Vancouver International Film Festival and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Are you looking for career information relevant to your arts degree? Come check out Work Your BA, a career workshop series specifically designed for art students. Find out what you can do with your major, learn how to improve your resume, discover the secrets to networking, and much, much more. For more information, visit www.arts.ubc.ca/students/workyourBA.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Last Tuesday, the Dalai Lama and Sir Ken Robinson, among others, spoke at the Vancouver Peace Summit about the importance of creativity and well-being in inspiring peace. Janelle Chung brings us her thoughts.
The Dalai Lama visited Vancouver last week to headline the Vancouver Peace Summit 2009, which was hosted by the Dalai Lama Center for Peace and Education. I was in the audience Tuesday for the Dalai Lama's last event in our city, entitled Women and Peace Building. The event was to highlight the importance of women in advancing peace. The summit included leaders who support women as primary agents of change. The audience was treated to a musical interlude before the Dalai Lama arrived. However, soon it became clear that the interlude would turn into a full-blown show, as the Dalai Lama was 45 minutes late for the summit. It turns out he was delayed because of his appearance at the Me Too We concert at GM Place, which brought together 16,000 student leaders. Musician Peter Buffett likened his extended set as the Monkees opening for the Beatles. Maria Shriver, the First Lady of California, and Jody Williams, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, finally walked on stage. Jody Williams decided to bring up the, quote, big elephant in the room, end quote, and took center stage to talk about Tibet. During the panel discussion, she left her seat empty on behalf of Tibet. When the Dalai Lama finally arrived, he entered a dialogue with Maria Shriver on compassion, poverty, and the role of females in peace. The Dalai Lama declared earlier in the summit that he was a feminist, much to the joy of the mostly female crowd. When asked if there would ever be a female Dalai Lama, he responded that, if a female Dalai Lama can be more effective, then why not? No problem. He also called for media reporting to be more balanced and focus equal attention on positive stories as it does on the negative ones. The following panel discussion included notable participants who had varied backgrounds in arts, politics, philanthropy, and education. They spoke on their childhood, beliefs in equality, and plans for local and global change. The consensus of the afternoon was that women cannot change the world or build peace if they're shut out of the meetings where such discussions are held. Kim Campbell, former Prime Minister of Canada, said that peace process discussions should be pressured to include women. Swanee Hunt, who is the founding director of the Women in Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, asked why, when in talks over the peace agreement in the former Yugoslavia, she was the only woman in the room. Hunt recounted a story on why women were refused entry in peace negotiations in Africa. Tribal leaders felt that women are too compromising. Ila Bhatt, the founder of the Self-Employed Women's Association in India, believes that hunger and poverty are the biggest reasons for this gender discrepancy, while Fazil Hassan Abed, who is the chairman of BRAC, also known as the Bangladesh Rural Advancement Committee, believes a solution to gender inequality can be found by educating women and girls. Finally, Peter Buffett, who is an Emmy Award-winning musician and the co-chair of the Novo Foundation, likened the situation to making good investments and said women are, quote, undervalued, and if we invest in girls, someday the world will get around to recognize them, end quote. When the Dalai Lama was asked at the end of the panel, which also marked the end of the peace summit, what else he had to say, he lightheartedly remarked that, quote, I don't have much to say. Sometimes it seems repeat, 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 end quote.
Brad Pepink and Elias Amid went on campus to find out what students thought of the Dalai Lama's visit to Vancouver. Here is word on the street.
Did you know that the Dalai Lama recently came to Vancouver, and did you try to get tickets to go see him?
Yes, I did, and I actually was able to get a ticket to see him in a dialogue with Maria Schiffer and also some other women about the women and peace-building issues on last Tuesday.
Oh, wonderful. And how did you find that? Was it educational?
I think it was definitely a wonderful experience. It was, really amazing to see that so many people are doing a lot to help out with the world and also issues dealing with women in education.
And what do you think about the controversy that surrounds the Dalai Lama and how his visits across the world are very controversial again?
I think at the conference itself, they tried to be away from addressing such controversies. They did acknowledge the fact that there were Tibetan people attending the conferences, but it was pretty peaceful, I would say. Not much political unrest.
We are in the Student Union building with Silvio. And Silvio, the Dalai Lama was recently in Vancouver for a bit of a conference and he spoke. Was that under your radar? Did you try to get tickets or did you attend that event?
No, I didn't even know it was happening. I had no idea.
And did that make you, was that upsetting? Did you want to see him? Was that kind of a big event or was that kind of just a blip on the scope of the year?
Not really a big event for me, I guess.
Even though he is, a spiritual leader across the world, that's not really something that you'd have been interested in?
Well, I'm sure he's important, but it's just not something that's really, I guess, that important to me.
So I'm outside the Student Union building with Rick. And Rick, did you know that the Dalai Lama was recently in Vancouver? And did you manage to attend his event?
No, I knew he was here, but I was in Kamloops.
And was that upsetting? Did you try to get tickets or did you really want to see him?
I wouldn't. Upsetting is not the right word. But my daughter told me about him. She said he was, for an old guy, very funny. That was her comment.
And do you think it's important that the Dalai Lama come to Vancouver and spread his message? Is that something that, Vancouver is really missing out on, or is it a benefit to our society?
I think if I say that I'm missing the message, right? Because his message, I think he doesn't need to come and spread it. It's something that we should all know. And if we require him to come and spread it, then we're sort of missing the message, right?
BC Thunderbirds football team is in Saskatoon tonight to face the number 7 ranked Saskatchewan Huskies in the Shaw TV game. The Blue Line.
The Dalai Lama was recently in Vancouver. Did you try to attend this event?
I didn't, but I feel really badly that I didn't. I felt like I should have. I was a responsible citizen of the world, something I probably should have been at. But, that's, I guess, the apathy of my generation at the moment.
Certainly. I've actually been noting that the Dalai Lama seems to have this type of cult following, almost a mysticism around him. Do you think that if it was a spiritual leader from another faith, would you be just as interested? Or do you think there is this type of fascination with the Dalai Lama that kind of provokes people to go see him?
Well, I think that's sort of an unanswerable question the way you pose that. The fascination about him revolves around that sort of like higher level of peace that we all should be striving for. So if it was from another religion or following that didn't have that same sort of ideology, then no.
We are in the gallery with Ryan. And Ryan, the Dalai Lama was recently in town. Was that something that you tried to attend, or did you have any comments about that event?
I didn't show up in Vancouver until later in the week, so I didn't even realize that the Dalai Lama was here until later in the evening. So I didn't actually attend.
Would you have tried to attend? If you had known he was here, would you have modified your travel arrangements?
Indefinitely. When you get a chance in life to experience someone as enlightening as the Dalai Lama, like, everybody should, if they get the opportunity, try and take up on an offer like that, because it's once in a lifetime, and you never know what you can learn from it or gain from it when you go. So by all means, you should.
Did you attend the Dalai Lama's recent speech in Vancouver?
No, I wasn't able to go. I was busy at work, although I really wanted to go. I've been looking forward to it, so I was pretty disappointed that I couldn't make it.
Also last week, I had the pleasure of attending a panel discussion at SFU organized by the Impact on Communities Coalition, which investigated the effects of the upcoming Olympics on civil liberties. I'd like to bring you excerpts from the speeches made by David Eby and Matt Hearn. Hi, I'm Carrie Baptist. On September 28th, the Impact on Communities Coalition held a panel discussion at SFU looking at the possible effects of the upcoming 2010 Olympics on civil liberties here in Vancouver. I'd like now to bring you just some excerpts of a speech made by BC Civil Liberties Association Executive Director David Eby, here speaking about the new city bylaw amendments passed just this past summer in anticipation of the security challenges posed by the upcoming Games.
One of the documents I provided some excerpts from are the bylaw amendments that were passed by the City of Vancouver recently this June. And I've highlighted a few of the provisions there, but by no means are these all of the provisions. One of the ones I left out is that the zones over which these rules apply can be expanded or contracted at the arbitrary will of the city engineer. But some of the rules are that I've highlighted, a person must not carry any sign unless licensed to do so by the city on city-owned land, otherwise public property. And it doesn't say commercial sign or for a profit, or just says any sign. A person must not display any sign in a street unless the sign, quote, celebrates the 2010 Winter Games and creates or enhances a festive environment and atmosphere for the 2010 Olympic Games. A person must not cause any disturbance or nuisance interfering with the enjoyment of entertainment on city land by other persons. So we're not really going to define this, but if you create a disturbance that interferes with someone else's enjoyment of city entertainment, however you're doing that, you are violating a bylaw, a City of Vancouver bylaw. Now, never mind that there's a criminal law called breach of the peace where you can be arrested, taken off to jail without charge, and then released when the opportunity to breach the peace is over. Never mind that. We're talking about creating a disturbance. Maybe a chant like no homes, no peace, or 2010 homes, not 2010 games. Some of the exciting slogans around the Olympics opposition movement certainly could create a disturbance and made illegal under these bylaw amendments. Protest pens, maybe you've heard about the protest pens. They were briefly called free speech zones. They've perhaps wisely, after receiving legal counsel, been renamed safe assembly areas, which has upsetting implications. It's got upsetting implications for the areas outside the safe assembly area. I believe firmly that the safe assembly areas, the bylaws restricting free speech and signage, are directly related to Section 47 of the Host City Agreement. It says, quote, the city, the NOC, which is VANOC, the organizing committee, and the OCOG, the NOC is the Canadian Olympic Committee, and the OCOG is VANOC, shall ensure that no propaganda or advertising is placed within the Olympic venues, or, and it gets better, not just in the venues, but outside the Olympic venues in such a manner as to be within the view of what? Within the view of the television cameras covering the sports of the games, or what else? Of the spectators who have made their way down to the Olympic venues. So this contract, this clause that says we're going to keep free speech out of view of the spectators and the media, was signed by the mayor of the City of Vancouver in June 2003. He made this promise to the International Olympic Committee. Now, VANOC, on their website, appears to say that they're prepared to breach the contract. They say, quote, for those who wish to use the 2010 Winter Games to draw attention to areas of their interest, our security partners will ensure peaceful, lawful, and safe public demonstrations can occur outside of the venues in plain sight of the media and the public. What a relief. Protests will be allowed. But wait, there's a second half to the paragraph. Quote, safe assembly areas for this purpose. Safe assembly areas for this purpose are being proposed by Vancouver 2010 Integrated Security Unit, and they will be facilitated by the police of jurisdiction. So prepare to be facilitated into a safe assembly area in the near future. How are the homeless going to be treated? Well, ask the minister. He's in the paper. Quote, there's no movement to say we're going to take them to jail. No movement to say we're going to put them in a secure facility. But if you read the memos that were leaked from inside the housing ministry, they say, quote, as a last resort, this is a proposal to move people into shelter called the Assistance to Shelter Act, quote, as a last resort, and in order for the police officer to discharge their legal responsibility, the individual may be taken to police cells, either voluntarily or involuntarily, where they will be held until the extreme weather declaration is no longer in effect. Oh, extreme weather in Vancouver. How often does that happen? 37 days last year. 37 days. So we're going to hold someone who's homeless throughout the month of February because extreme weather in Vancouver is, guess what, 3 to 5 days of rain in a row. Well, at least the government's not telling us what we can wear. Oh, actually, yeah, they are. If you want to go into an Olympic venue, be prepared to be told what you can and can't wear. Let's say you're wearing a message. Let's say you're waving a sign that's carrying a political message. Quote, the spectators must be approached by venue security or other personnel and informed that no signage of any nature is allowed at the venue. That's the clean venue agreement that's part of the host city agreement that was signed. The last document I want to draw to your attention is the Vanoc Torch Run brochure. This is from a brochure euphemistically called Community Engagement Considerations, mailed to every city on the Olympic Torch Route by Vanoc. Distribution of any propaganda along the relay route is not permitted unless distributed by Vanoc or official OTR Torch Run sponsors, Torch Relay sponsors.
I'd like now to bring you some excerpts from the speech made by Matt Hearn, looking at the idea of authoritarian creep and what might be left behind after the Olympics are gone.
So I was working at a public school in North Vancouver, but at a private independent school in the North Vancouver district, a kid fell out of a tree and died. And it was, you know, horrible. It was horrific. It's every parent's nightmare. In response to that incident, though, after a series of kind of scares around liability, the District of North Vancouver and the School Board of North Vancouver banned tree climbing for all kids. Which, from one level, you look at it and you go, okay, I understand that. I understand how in a panic or in terror and fear of lawsuit, and particularly in fiscally challenged climate in North Vancouver schools, you can see how that answer, that might be a response. Turn from another, just slightly different perspective. You look at it and you think, really? I work for a school that prides itself on the freedom and responsibility that we offer to kids, and I now formally have to disallow kids from climbing trees? How did I get there? How did that happen? And so from there, just that kind of catalyzed for me thinking about creep, about the way that authoritarian control and authoritarian mandates oftentimes creep into our lives sort of on the backs of other stuff, kind of behind things, kind of from a sideways way, and then all of a sudden the culture or the city just has shifted in a fundamental way, and we barely have had a chance to talk about it or notice how the hell that happened. And one of the things, as I started thinking about this and doing some research and some writing about it, was the degree to which safety, security, is contingent. And I think that we need to constantly kind of remind ourselves that the idea of safety, the idea of security, it's not a thing, it's not an artifact, it's contingent, it depends. It depends on context, it's politicized. But so often in conversations, in public conversations about that, the idea of safety is unchallenged. And security just ends up meaning keeping order, keeping things in place, keeping power in place. And I noticed for many years that radicals, that leftists, that anarchists have all kinds of trouble actually addressing that in a lot of the conversations, which are, how do we begin to think that cops keep us safe? What's the logic behind that? How is it that we begin to think that CCTVs begin to make us secure? And I think that those questions are super important to pay attention to. And I think of this in terms of the Olympics, well, I'm in this particular way, which is that it's not just the Olympics, right? The Olympics are the thing that we could focus on, and they're like massive. I mean, they're just so freaking ridiculous, right? In so many ways, and so obnoxious, so profoundly obnoxious. But the Olympics didn't come out of nothing. They came out of a neoliberal worldview, and they happened to be the kind of crowning glory of that worldview. But that logic, those arguments, that worldview, they're not going to disappear with the Olympics. They're going to be here. And in fact, as several folks have mentioned, is that very oftentimes, the things that are brought in supposedly just for the Olympics, well, you know, we need this kind of security measure, we need these extra cops, we need those cameras, we need these kind of restrictions because of the Olympics. But then the Olympics go away and those things are still here. And it's one more way that a worldview and an epistemology and a politics gets advanced a little further, and all of a sudden the culture and the city just moves a little farther ahead, and we can't figure out how we got there and how do we resist that. And that's consistently and the mode of operation for all these kind of circuses, right? They have their own logic, but they also have a larger logic, and they're also embedded in other deeper, more fundamental logics that we have to remember. So I would say that it behooves us to resist the Olympics for all we're worth, resist every part of them, and do everything we can to mess the circus up in any way possible. I think that's absolutely true. But I think it also really behooves us to remember what's left behind, to remember the logic that got us to this point. How did we end up with this shit show on our hands? What was the logic that got us there? What were the arguments that got us there? And what's going to be left behind? And how can we begin to undermine those more fundamental logics? Those more fundamental logics that keep ending us up with a security guard in every library and in every street, and security guards hired by the BIAs walking up and down our streets. How do we end up there? And how do those logics, how can we attack those logics? Not just the event, but actually the logic and the arguments kind of at their root.
We're now going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. Next, we bring you more about civil liberties in the Olympics right after these public service announcements.
The CRTC is asking the public for comments as part of a nationwide review of campus and community radio. That review includes this station. We're asking that you let the CRTC know what local, nonprofit, volunteer-driven radio means to you and your community. Maybe you're a fan of community radio. Maybe you've donated. Or maybe you're a volunteer. Then please write to the CRTC and make sure you tell them you support the idea of stable funding for the sector. To submit your comments, visit the website crtc.notlong.com and look for review number 418, the review of campus and community radio. The last day for comments is Friday, October 16th.
First learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more? Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website www.spec.bc.ca for more information.
Welcome back to News 101. The current time is 5:37. Last month, we brought you a report on the BCCLA's plans to train community members to act as legal observers during the upcoming Olympics. This week, the Vancouver Police Department and the Integrated Security Unit announced that they will undergo the same training. Here's Megan Turcotto with that report.
In response to concerns that freedom of expression will not be protected during the Olympic Games, Vancouver Police Department spokesperson, Constable Lindsay Houghton, offered these assurances.
Well, what I can say is that there will be no protest-only zones. There aren't going to be any extraordinary efforts made to restrict protests and contain them because of the games. Law that protects free speech will be in place before, during, and after the games. We will uphold the law, and you know, no one's going to be allowed to violate it, but protesters will be certainly free to gather in any public space as long as their actions are lawful.
I asked Robert Holmes of the BCCLA to respond to Constable Howden's comments and discuss his concerns about what will and will not be considered legal during the Games.
The difficulty, of course, is that the way that the provincial government and the City of Vancouver and Whistler and Richmond have treated this issue is by leaving things to the last minute and then springing a host of bylaws and enabling laws and other legal provisions that on their face are written in a very broad fashion and will so restrict free speech. For example, they have at the end of July come up with a bylaw in the City of Vancouver that says that celebratory signs of the Olympics are okay, but anything that's critical is not okay. And then they defined a whole host of areas, including the Vancouver Public Library, in and around it, and in and around any number of other downtown parks and venues that typically are used for people to protest and to make their viewpoints known. Those are all places where right now, on the face of the law, such action is banned. And we think those are unconstitutional, but because Vancouver left it to a very late stage and therefore made it difficult for people to get court actions challenging those up and running, and I should mention that we've, through two people, have started such an action, But who knows whether it'll get determined by the courts before the Olympics come along. So for the police officer to say, and I respect him and think that he is obviously a good professional law enforcement officer, but for him to say that free expression will be allowed to take place in Vancouver as long as it's within the law becomes somewhat of a circular proposition, that if his masters in the city of Vancouver or in the province of British Columbia put in place laws that really aim at squelching free speech during the Olympics, then that's very problematic.
I guess to encourage the protection of free speech during the Games, your organization is training legal observers, and the police have actually agreed to go through that training as well to increase awareness of this program. What do you hope that the VPD, an Integrated Security Unit, will get out of the legal observer training?
Well, two things. One, we wanted to have the legal observer training program done in a manner where the session that was for people who want to be legal observers could come along without fear of thinking that there were going to be people from the VPD or the ISU there who would be busy engaging in surveillance and whatever else, and so would inhibit their willingness to come along or their willingness to actually go through the training program. So we set up a separate program where we would put on for the police the same kind of training so they'd see what we were saying to people who might want to be legal observers. What we're trying to do with this legal observer program is to tell people what the law provides in relation to what police and other law enforcement people can and can't do, and what is legitimate in terms of what people can and ought to do in relation to observing, and also when they are observing things, when they might want to take a record of what's going on, if protests are taking place or people are wanting to demonstrate and exercise their lawful rights of expression, and if they're interfered with.
I asked Constable Houghton to explain why the VPD had agreed to have officers take BCCLA legal observer training and what they hoped their members got out of the seminar.
We certainly welcome any opportunity that we get to share information with the BCCLA, and we agree with the BC Civil Liberties Association. We also want these games to be a showcase for democracy and free speech. Our goal for the 2010 Olympics is that they be safe, accessible, and welcoming. We want the entire world to appreciate that we're an open society, and we place the highest values on the rights of the individual, not the least of which is the right to assembly and free speech.
Presumably, your constables are already trained to respect people's liberties. What additionally are they going to get out of this training?
Well, not knowing what the BCCLA is going to be teaching, it's hard for me to speculate, but certainly any information that they give our officers, you know, we'll take back and we'll incorporate it into our training, and we look for any opportunity, like I said, to improve communication both with organizations and improve the communication skills of our officers.
Thus, free speech advocates and city officials remain divided about whether or not freedom of expression will be respected come game time.
Thanks to Megan for that coverage. It's time for another break. Up next is arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
We are now going to practice our continental way of eating. We pick up our silverware, index finger in the back of the fork, index finger on top of the knife.
What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
Luckily, dining at the Sub is a little less formal.
The Honor Roll Sushi Bar. Get maki rolls, rice bowls, and bento boxes made fresh all day. Don't forget to ask about our party platters. Located in the basement of the Sub, the Honor Roll Sushi Bar is open Monday through Friday. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society.
Radio.
Oh,
radio.
Uh-huh.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:45 and time for the Arts Report. And for that, we go to Paul Zerbier. Paul speaks with Tom Schultz, the director of theater at UBC's new production, M.K. Wozniak.
Hello, this is Paul Zerbier with CITR, and I'm here just after the opening night of M.K. Wozniak with the director, Tom Schultz. And we're just going to have a bit of a discussion about what the play is about. And I understand it's the world premiere of M.K. Wozniak.
That's right. Buchner's original play, Wozniak, of course, has been around for many, many years, but this is an original adaptation that's getting its premiere here tonight.
Okay, Tom. And can you tell me, it was a very exciting play. I felt it was kind of an experimental play. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the play is about?
Well, it's basically, Buchner's original text is based on a real-life case where in 1821, a former soldier and impoverished German peasant murdered his mistress. He stabbed her 6 times with a broken sword blade in a fit of jealous despair. And he was put on trial and convicted. He never tried to claim that he didn't commit the crime. And he was sentenced to be executed, to be beheaded. And then stories started to come out by people who knew him who said that he had heard voices, he'd had auditory and visual hallucinations. And so the case was reopened to see if he should be held criminally responsible or not, based on the question of his sanity. And in the end, he was found fit to stand trial and was beheaded. And this was a very controversial case in the 19th century. And all the pro and con death penalty stuff and all of the criminal responsibility and mental illness, all those arguments that are still very relevant to us today inspired Buchner to write his play loosely based on that case. And in this production, we take the historical case of Wozniak, we take Buchner's play about Wozniak, and also the modern-day case of a Vietnam veteran who ended up on death row for a murder, and sort of intertwine those to seek out different patterns and connections between those stories.
To me, there was a translation between what happened in the past with Wozniak and what was happening in the present. What kind of connections are you hoping that the audience is going to make from the production?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping it just remains in the spirit of Buchner's original play, which is probing questions about the role that societal forces and biological forces, you know, proneness to mental illness, places in a class system, exploitation by a capitalist system, or military service, subjugation by sort of higher forces, combat trauma, all those things. What role do they play in the creation of a criminal, of criminal behavior? And what role should they or should they not play in our assessment of a criminal's activities when it comes time to pass judgment on someone who has found themselves in a life of crime?
Context of the play is set within an experimental laboratory setting. I felt there was quite a bit of commentary with the level of sarcasm in the play about the role of the researchers and what they were trying to accomplish in their studies. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Well, I think Buchner, in his creation of the character of the doctor, who figures prominently in our production, I think Buchner was very skeptical about even though he was a scientist himself. What really intrigues me is the idea that science is able to sort of reduce a very subjective human experience to objective data. And where in that is the experience of the person who's experiencing it? And sort of an image that I've kept with me since I first read the play many, many years ago, and that appears in this production and that has sort of driven me all these years, is when Wozniak is experiencing feelings of intense jealousy and rage, and the doctors are talking about his blood pressure and his facial muscles and all those kinds of things. And I've just continually been fascinated by the statistical, kind of cold statistical breakdown of an experience that to the subject is beyond all of that kind of analysis and is this amorphous and very personal and very powerful experience.
Yeah, it reminds me of a production, I can't remember the name, but you may remember it was I saw it at the Vancouver Playhouse a few years ago, and it was about a woman that was going through cancer
yes,
treatment.
Wit. Yeah, Wit.
Wit, yeah, and it wonderful show, and it had that same kind of clinical approach to a very serious and personal issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm hoping we don't sort of, you know, unnecessarily malign those in the scientific profession, but again, I'm trying to stay close to Buchner's intention, and Buchner is clearly parodying the scientific mindset and certainly showing it as an oppressive force in Wojciech's life. And there's no getting around the fact that, you know, we've drawn the connections in our production between that fictitious doctor's attitudes and the infamous Holmesburg prison experiments that went on in the States. And, you know, if you quote Dr. Albert...
Sorry, just to give that some context, that's the experiments that were done from the 50s to the 70s on psychedelic drug, and it was under the vicious governance, I guess, of the CIA in the U.S. Is that correct?
Yes, and even before that, he was testing dermatological products. He was a dermatologist, and he used a prison population as the ideal laboratory to do tests on human subjects that he would not be able to do on the outside. And we've included a number of quotations that come straight from the mouth of Dr. Albert Kligman, and it's very tough to differentiate between the words of the doctor from Buchner's play, who seems like such an outrageous caricature of an evil scientist, and this very real man, Dr. Albert Kligman, who was a very, very esteemed a dermatologist in his day.
It's shocking just the way he just looks at these prisoners as an opportunity to do some experiments.
It's about that loss of perspective on the human at the center of the experiment.
And the loss of humanity.
Absolutely. Buchner was obsessed with the dehumanizing processes that went on in society, and we're just trying to sort of find what mirror images exist between his 19th century pre-unification Germany and our current realities.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much. Do you want to let our listeners know when the production is running to? I understand it's October 1st to 10th.
That's right.
The first tonight being the opening night.
Next week it's Monday through Saturday, every night at 7:30 p.m.
Okay, well, there you are. And this is Paul Zerbe with CITR and the Arts Report, inviting you to come see M.K. Wojciech at the Frederick Wood Theater at UBC.
Thanks, Paul. M.K. Wojciech is running at the Frederick Wood Theater until tomorrow night. It's now time for your look at UBC Athletics, and for that, here's Wilson Wong with Thunderbird Ion Sports.
The 1-4 UBC Thunderbirds football team is in Saskatoon tonight to face the number 7-ranked Saskatchewan Huskies in the Shaw TV Game of the Week. UBC is coming off a 50-26 loss to Calgary, and they now face a near impossible climb into a playoff spot, sitting dead last in the Canada West Conference. UBC continues to struggle stopping the run, with Calgary racking up 378 rushing yards last week. Saskatchewan should be a better match for UBC, as the Huskies rank last in the conference for rushing offense, averaging just 61.8 yards on the ground. Saskatchewan won both games they played against UBC last season. Kickoff is coming up at 6 p.m. and you can see the game live on Shaw TV. The regular season starts tonight for UBC's two ice hockey teams. The men are in Regina to play the Cougars. UBC went 1-4 during the preseason, although one of the losses came against the AHL's Abbotsford Heat. After an injury-plagued first half of last year, UBC managed to finish fifth in the regular season, just ahead of Regina. But they will have to do better this year, with the playoff field reduced from 6 teams to 4. Their home opener is next Friday against the Manitoba Bisons. The UBC women's hockey team will start their year by hosting the University of Calgary tonight, a game you can hear right here on CITR 101.9 FM. The Dinos return to the CIS after 7 years in the Alberta College League, but they've had trouble filling their bench for games as sprains, breaks, concussions, and re-aggravated injuries have taken their toll. Calgary head coach and former Olympian Danielle Goyette will do her best to cobble together three lines to go up against a Thunderbird squad poised to build on last season's successes. UBC coach Nancy Wilson has focused on beefing up the blue line and overall physical presence with the help of some new recruits. Jeff Sargent will be here with our pregame show starting at 7 o'clock tonight, and Tyler Noble and Chandler Grieve will have the call starting at 7:30. The UBC women's soccer team is looking to start a mid-season charge. They have just 8 points after 6 games, but starting tonight, the Thunderbirds will play 6 straight games at home over the next 3 weekends. They play Fraser Valley today. The game has actually just started at Thunderbird Park, but here's Coach Dick Mosher describing Fraser Valley's style of play.
They play a little different style than most. They're a fair bit more direct. So they're looking at getting balls in behind us into the corners, getting our backs turned sort of thing, as opposed to a more possession type of game that you would see, for example, the next weekend when Alberta comes in, and they're pretty well straight possession.
After tonight's game, UBC will play 4th-ranked Victoria tomorrow night at 5 p.m. The men's team is looking to rebound this weekend after losing to Trinity Western. They will also play Fraser Valley in Victoria. UBC faces the Cascades tonight at 7:15 p.m. Then they will play fifth-ranked Victoria tomorrow night at Thunderbird Park. Several UBC teams are Bellingham-bound over the next few days. The two cross-country squads are taking part in the 36th annual Viking Invitational starting tomorrow. The men's team go into the competition ranked fifth in the NAIA, while the women's team went from being unranked last week to number 11. The women's golf team is also competing at a Western Washington University event. Their tournament starts Thanksgiving Monday. It will be the first competitive action for the players in almost a month. In men's preseason volleyball, UBC beat the Dalhousie Tigers 3-1 in Halifax Thursday night to split a two-match series. UBC had lost in straight sets to Dalhousie on Wednesday. They continue their preseason in the Maritimes today and tomorrow. UBC is starting a two-match series against the New Brunswick Varsity Reds. That's your Thunderbird Eye look ahead to this weekend's UBC sports action. I'm Wilson Wong.
And now with your weekend weather report, here's Denise Diadic.
Here's your Thanksgiving weekend forecast for October 9th to 12th. We've had a picturesque week, and it should last into the weekend. This evening should be partly cloudy, with some light northeast winds bringing a chill, around 5 degrees. Saturday should be mostly sunny, with a high of 13 degrees and a low of 1. By Sunday, however, clouds will be moving in due to a frontal low-pressure system. So it will be partly cloudy with a high of 14 degrees and a low of 2. Thanksgiving Monday will be cloudy with a high of 13 and a low of 2. Humidity will be increasing, so there is a probability of light showers. All in all, it's still a great autumn, so enjoy the nice days and cool evenings. Perfect for a warm dinner with the family and friends. Currently it's 12 degrees and slightly cloudy at YVR. That's your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club. Take care and have a great Thanksgiving. For News 101, I'm Denise Diadic.
Thanks, Denise. And that's our program for October 9th, 2009. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Megan Hurtado produced this radio program. For more news, join us next Monday at 5 for another edition of News 101. I'm Carrie Baptist. From the entire news team here at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Hot Mess on 101.9 FM, CITR.